You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Rob Hollis is here with me. Michael Rosenbaum is here with me. A lot of cool stuff to talk about, Rob, before we get into this great interview, because this is, I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Well, I didn't.
You're right. Well, first of all, I want to say thanks to all the fans for, you know, when you guys are following the show, please subscribe. Please write a review. It really helps the show. Podcasts are free, and we're trying to keep them that way, and we love what we're doing. But
we're trying to make it so Michael doesn't have to go sign up for a movie he doesn't want to do.
Well, I would just like to do this. To tell you the truth, if I get more people listening to this podcast, this is therapy for me. I know it's therapy for a lot of people out there, and I love you for listening. So we're just trying to grow the audience. So tell your friend, tell your mom, if you sit down with your family at dinner, just have everybody grab their phone, subscribe to the podcast, write a review. And this thing's going to start blowing up, and we'll do more and more interviews. We'll get bigger and better guests. I don't know if that's possible because the guests are pretty amazing, like the one today. But thank you for all the kind support. Throw out to Fat Scooters, who just brought me the most dopest little fat. Just check their Fat Scooters out. You got to get one. I'm going to get you guys a code, hopefully, to get a discount on these things, but they're incredible. Our guest today, Rob, did you know a lot about John Cryer?
No. I mean, I knew he was on 2.5 Men.
That's good.
I did not watch that show, but my brother and dad watched.
He was in Pretty in Pink.
Yep.
He's done a lot of shows.
He's in Ryan Hansen Solves Crimes.
Yep. I love Ryan Hansen. Got to throw out Ryan Hansen. Mm-hmm. He's been through a lot in terms of, like, you know, shows that didn't last. And I can...
he's also been on a show that lasted a long time.
I can relate, but he waited and waited and persevered and then got 2.5 Men. What's great is he's so candid and open about talking about Charlie Sheen and the shit that took place, which I was just going to talk about Lex Luthor and him appearing on Supergirl as Lex Luthor, which is pretty freaking cool. So it was Lex Luthor interviewing Lex Luthor. But then he started opening up about Charlie Sheen and his experience. And it wasn't like, I think, you know, no matter what he says, he's so genuine that it comes off like he just is a guy that wants to work and enjoy life and enjoy people around him. And there was some, you guys know the deal with what happened, and the whole show kind of fell apart, and with Ashton coming back on. So he'll tell that story, and he's very open. I didn't expect him to get as open as he was, and he talks about being in drag, which I've been in drag many times, as you know.
You're in drag right now.
Yeah, and of course we talk about Lex Luthor and the...
What was Lex Luthor?
Lex Luthor was a supervillain, one of the probably the best supervillains in fantasy.
That Gene Hackman one.
He was my favorite, yeah.
I think he's
the quintessential.
That's it.
Yeah.
No one should have done it. No one should have done it after him.
I think nobody should have done it after him until a certain person came along.
Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah. You'll enjoy this interview. We talk about Lex Luthor. We talk about Supergirl. We talk about expectations. We talk about how hard it is to do a new role when people are expecting so much, and how he takes it in stride, and just a great guy. We talk about how he showed up a week early to the podcast. Let's
not give it all away. Let's get to this interview.
Let's get inside of John Cryer.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You. Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Hey, I saw that episode.
You did, John Cryer. You're looking at an episode it was an episode of Smallville called Onyx, where I wore that mask, right? I think.
Yes, it was the one where you split into two Lexes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you watch
Lex.
That?
Well, because I used to see the show.
Right.
I didn't see every episode.
Sure.
But,
I watched every episode of 2.5 Men, you fuck.
It got ugly very quickly.
Yeah.
Here, folks. I remembered that episode partially because, I'm playing Lex Luthor on Supergirl.
Yes, you are.
First of all, what was great about the Lex as presented by Smallville was he was a very nuanced character. He was very, it was a little bit of a departure from the comics. I guess it would be closest to the Superboy Lex Luthor.
You see his journey.
Yes.
To becoming evil as you see young Clark Kent becoming, Superman.
Yes, exactly.
So you sound like you knew your comic books like before you got this role.
To a certain extent. I've delved into Luthor a little more
recently.
Yeah. And then
you've got a great head.
Thank you.
Like, you've got a really wonderful shaped dome. Is it called a pate? Is that what it is?
It is called a pate.
A pate.
Yes. And my wife is a very big fan of it as well. And actually, when I was first approached about it, when the producers called me, I thought, why me? I wouldn't be the first person I would choose to play.
Wait. They came to you first.
Yes. And it was a weird, circuitous thing, actually. First, I got an email from Bill Prady, who is one of the producers of Big Bang Theory.
Right.
Who said, want to let you know, I've been hearing through the grapevine that you're about to get asked to play a character that rhymes with Schmex Schmuthor. And I was like, what on earth is he talking about?
You didn't believe it.
I did not believe it. Then I got a text from an old friend of mine from summer camp, who said, one of the producers of Supergirl is looking to talk to you.
What?
And I was like, this is a very unconventional approach. You know, they find my old friends from summer camp. He said, hey, can I give her your number? I said, sure. And then Jessica Quiller, who's one of the executive producers on the thing, said, I just happen to know some of your old friends from summer camp. I swear to God. And would you be interested in being Lex Luthor on the show? Because DC is only letting us have him for 3 episodes. So we're trying to make it into a big deal.
You know, what's funny is, you know, online people are like, are you going to play Lex Luthor on Supergirl? Are you gonna? No one ever asked me to do any of this. No one ever. So people are still like, why aren't you doing this? I'm like, well, no one asked me.
Yeah, there's that big hole in the plan.
And, you know, by the way, first of all, something funny happened that I got to tell you folks out there. Last week, I was sitting at my computer wearing probably the same sweatpants as I am today. I like to be comfortable. Thank you. Thank you. And I see at the door on my, you know, the cameras, the security cameras, that there's a bald man at the door. And I think, oh, it's probably a delivery. Could be anything. So I kept writing.
Stalker.
And all of a sudden, a good-looking bald man comes up and walks into the office with my assistant, Jess. And I look at him and I go, oh, shit, that's John Cryer. And he's a week early.
Timelines have never been my strong suit.
Hey, man.
You said, hey, let's get together on Tuesday. And but you did specifically in the email say exactly which Tuesday you wanted us to get together. But my mind only listened to the, oh, Tuesday, which I just assumed was the next Tuesday. But it wasn't the next Tuesday.
So, you know, what's funny is I am always wrong. Rob, you can attest to that. He's over there. He's on the microphone. But yes. I get things wrong. My mind is all over the place. So I need people to just be very understanding with me because I don't mean to. But I'm like, well, what's this? And we're like, did you read your email? I'm like, not all of it. That's kind of me. I'm a scatterbrain. And so I need people who are patient. Go, dude, this is the. But you were. It was so funny. You're so kind. We walked around the house. We talked for a bit. And it was like, I don't know. I thought it was just, it was endearing. It was sweet. It was like, I felt bad because I was like, you're not going to come back next week now, huh?
Yeah.
You're busy.
There's
you
no
don't
way
have time for me.
That I'm coming back. No, you know, this is not, sadly, this is not atypical for me. I love having a lot of things going on, but I'm actually not good at keeping track of them.
You showed up to the set a week early for Lex Luthor.
Sure. Yes,
and you're like,
exactly.
I'm ready, guys.
Ready, guys.
Well, we're not ready for you.
Let's start shooting this.
Right.
No, that did not occur, thankfully. I have to always have a bunch of things going at once, or I just feel bereft. I feel lost as a performer.
Well, explain that to me. Do you feel like if you really don't have a lot going on, do you get depressed?
It takes a while to sneak up on me, but I would say that comes into play because you just feel irrelevant. You know, if you don't feel like you're applying.
Irrelevant to whom?
To whoever you're trying to reach. I mean, who do you perform for?
Well, when I say that, I just think, you know, my whole goal now is to try and not think of it like irrelevance as much as it is. It's like I'm doing things for me and what I want to do and whether it is relevant to other people. And, you know, I'm sort of figuring that out now. Maybe it's a midlife crisis. It might be.
Just get a nicer car. You'll be fine.
But, but you know, I do notice, like, I went and did my buddy Dax's live podcast in San Antonio, which Rob also produces that show, right, Rob?
Yep.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
Yeah.
That show is, he is a magnificent host.
He's great. And we had, it was like 2,500 people. And at the Majestic Theater. It was me, Monica, and Dax, and we just sat there. And for 2 hours, it was just this energy. And afterwards, I was like, oh, I want to keep doing things like this. I want. So when I do things, I feel more energetic. I feel more relevant. Mm-hmm. And when I don't, I do slip into little bouts of anxiety, funk. Do you get anxiety?
Oh, yes. Terrible anxiety. Still get terrible performance anxiety.
I do, too.
Which is crazy.
Why?
People, there's no reason, especially when I used to do Two and a Half Men, which...
Live studio audience.
Yes. Live studio audience, which is a little nerve-wracking.
For 10 years?
It's 12 years.
12 years.
He said, that's a humble brag. only 12.
12!
Longest running multi-camera sitcom in the history of broadcast television. But anyway.
But anyway.
No, and it actually is no longer. Big Bang Theory just passed it probably last week. Wow. But anyway, neither here nor there. I'm not angry.
I liked it better. I like Two and a Half Men better than Big
Thank
Bang.
You. But no, I...
Well, performance anxiety. Go ahead.
But it's ridiculous because in multi-camera comedy, you can screw up in front of the audience and the audience loves it.
Yeah.
They could not care less. They have a great time mm-hmm. no matter what. They're here to have they don't want you to do the show exactly as planned.
No, it's boring.
You know, exactly. They want to be in Hollywood and see how the sausage is made, you know, see all the ugliness,
yeah.
see the disgusting underbelly. And so that should have been an area in which there was no, where I was absolutely free and just enjoying myself and performing the comedy I love with writing that I loved, by the way, the wonderful writing on that show. Terrific.
But you got nervous.
But no, every Friday, a basket case. Every Friday.
Isn't that something?
Why? Why,
John, you and I Why? Have the same problem because this is what I don't understand. I tell people this. I go and do stand up and if I kill it, if I do really well, but then I wake up and the whole next day is stressed out, freaking out about the next night that I'm going to do it. Uh-huh. And it's like, well, it doesn't make sense. If you did well at something, what's the psychology? There's got to be a psychologist out there. Please, if you can help me. Help John. We should be like more confident with what we're doing. We killed it. There's no reason for the next Friday in a 12-year show, you're doing all these episodes. You should have eventually just been so comfortable by the 50th Friday.
Absolutely.
And you weren't.
And I was not. And I was not. Usually for me, it was because there was bits I really wanted to do really well. So I would be overthinking it and thinking, okay, how am I gonna, you know, do this? But for me also, I couldn't tell if the anxiety informed the character in a good way.
Wow.
Because I always play anxious characters. I mean, that was one of the things that's fun about Lex is that...
He's not anxious.
He's not anxious.
Which probably gave you anxiety.
No, I had a blast. I felt honestly more comfortable and confident playing Lex than anything I've done.
All right, we're going to talk about that, but I'm going to save that so people just keep listening in here.
Okay.
Because we're going to talk about the episode and your experience at the end, because I definitely want to talk about that. But I think it probably stems from childhood, right? Were you always sort of a nervous kid? Did you get anxiety?
Oh, yes.
Were you picked on?
I was picked on a bit. You know, I wasn't like I was a little chunky. You know, I wasn't.
You were chunky?
Yeah, I wasn't. I recall a couple of instances of bullying, but nothing terrible. You know, nothing like that. A lot of people experience much worse than I. And so, but I never felt confident. I never felt
worthy.
I never felt like at home in my own skin growing up. I don't know why.
Did your dad tell you he loved you?
Yes, he did. My parents were divorced, so I could go and blame it on that, perhaps.
Sure. How old were you when that happened?
I was four.
Four.
I was only vaguely aware of a lot of it. But that being said, who knows? I think it's just part of my being.
Persona?
Because so many times in my life, I revert to that even when the external triggers aren't there. You know, I think it's just me.
Is there a feeling of, I mean, there's different versions of anxiety. Is it like, I'm not good enough? I've got to prove myself? Or is it just something innate? There's something that's just part of you that...
It's just something innate. Usually what I will do is I'll fixate on an external problem that needs to be solved somehow.
Like what?
Or like my co-star is having a mental breakdown on the internet. and
well, that's only happened on one show. Yes, granted, it lasted 12 years. Rob, are you gonna say?
It was Ashton Kutcher, right?
Yes,
it was Ashton Kutcher.
Absolutely. You called it. Yeah, sorry, Ashton. Break. Sorry, I gotta out you, Ashton. Right. But my point being, like, I would go through some drama, and I would fixate on the external aspect of that. But then when it was solved in some way, I would just move on to another one.
Another problem.
Yes.
Another issue.
That for some reason, you know, I needed to worry about. And then so I've looked at it and said, you know what? Maybe I just need to worry. There's just this part of me that needs to be hyper aware of my surroundings.
Boy.
And always trying to figure out how I'm going to get screwed.
I mean, if you're embracing that, maybe that's a real healthy thing to do. It's like, hey, I'm neurotic. I'm a neurotic Jew. I freak out about everything. If I just embrace this and just let everything go and know that this is how my... Then when anxiety comes, it's just anxiety. It's just part of me.
It may be that's it. I don't have the benefit of being Jewish, so I don't have that cultural information.
Right. Crier? In me, but Crier's... What is Crier?
Crier is probably Welsh. I recently did that whole ancestry thing, and they actually... I did a show called Who Do You Think You Are, where they give you a book that is this incredibly encyclopedic...
Yeah, you did that with other celebrities, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's an incredibly encyclopedic look into your ancestry, and I am Scottish as fuck. I am so Scottish. It's crazy.
Really?
And I did not know that. I assumed that I was from, you know, generally Great Britain and that area, but it's super duper Scottish.
I could see it. If you grew a bigger beard and started talking like this.
This, yes.
You could fucking do it.
I don't know. Don't have, you know, the classic red hair, or I'm not comfortable in kilts.
Have you put on a kilt before?
I have not.
I have.
Okay, how did you feel?
We've got one.
We've got one.
Do I have a kilt? I think I do have a kilt.
Okay, let's get it.
If it's your kilt, that just feels wrong.
And I free ball. You don't want any part of that.
That's the whole point of a kilt. That's my understanding.
Yeah, they breathe. You could just breathe. Yeah, you're wearing a skirt, but your balls are
hanging out there.
And fresh.
Yes. Hello, ladies.
So you got along with your mom, you got along with your dad. They were split up, but did they get along? Were they?
They did. And the hardest thing was my dad was a performer, was an actor. He remains an actor, even at 80 plus years old.
Wow.
Still auditions for stuff. And he moved to California. That was the hardest thing. He moved when I was about 6 years old. So, and I grew up in New York City. So that was the hardest thing, was that he remarried and moved away, because, you know, that was sort of the next phase of his career, was trying to make his way in the movie business.
Right. And how old were you?
I was six, and that happened till I was about 15. Then he moved back to New York. Actually,
okay, because in those years, 15. Though, you feel abandoned, no matter what.
Yeah. And what had happened at one point, you know, when my dad had moved out, you know, obviously there was the abandonment issues and all that stuff. But then at one point, he tried to move back in. But at that point, my mom was done. And my mom said, no, thanks.
Wait, you know? he was like, oh, like, I want to get this, make this work?
Yeah. And my mom no longer
did. Shut
him
down.
Yeah. And I totally get it. They've remained on good terms, but you know what? They should never have been
married.
Does
he still want to go there? Does he still try to creep in every once in a while?
No, he's remarried. I love my stepmom. Well, the crazy thing is my mom and my stepmother are great friends.
Who are you?
I know.
My mother and father hate each other.
Oh,
they
haven't talked
in 15 years. My mom just hates, you don't understand. My mom and my sister don't talk. My mom and my brother don't talk. Mm-hmm. My mom and my dad don't talk. We barely talk. It's a most dysfunctional.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah. But you're talking about two people that get divorced, and now their partners are all friends, and they talk, and they...
Oh, yeah.
How lucky and weird is that?
My half-brothers and sisters, my stepmother's children with my dad, used to live in my mom's house occasionally.
Come on. I
swear to God. What it was my mom and my dad loved each other, were great friends. They came from small towns in the Midwest. to the big city.
Where in the Midwest?
My dad from Ohio, my mom from Indiana.
I'm from Indiana. I grew up in Indiana.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay. I used to go for my summers there with my grandparents all the time.
Nice.
in Dunreath, Indiana, which is, yeah, it's tiny. There's 8 people in Dunreath. There's a filling station and
that's all you need.
That's it. That's all you need. They loved each other. Absolutely. But the reason they got married was because everybody was just saying, hey, when are you two getting married? You know,
yeah.
They probably should never have been married. And, you know, my dad wanted to be a performer and be, you know, actually he started as a minister. She thought she was going to be a minister's wife.
Wow.
And then he realized, no, I'm
was she
actor.
His first?
Yeah, I believe so.
Wow.
I believe so. So, you know, he basically wasn't made for that relationship. And so when they split up, he fell in love with my stepmother, but felt bad about leaving the kids, you know, and at one point tried to move back in or hoped to move back in. And my mom said, no, you know what? We're better separate. You know, this was, by the way, Blockbuster information to me, because all of a sudden I understood why my stepmother wanted to move to California. In addition to the career thing, was, you know, you've got a guy who still wants to move back in with his kids, you know. So it's really a very
eye opener.
Yeah, it was a big eye opener, and all of a sudden I understood the motivations of everybody involved.
Right. Don't you wish that, you know, like Sandler would have done in Wedding Singer, information I could have used yesterday?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Well, no, you know what? I understand why parents don't fill their kids in on every aspect of why they're getting divorced. You know, there's some stuff the kids can't
process. My parents
didn't
need to tell me anything. I was pretty much aware when my dad, okay. Oh boy, I got some stories.
So you got them contemporaneously. You were aware as this stuff was going down.
I just was like, what is going on? There's so much passive aggression. There's so much like, just you could feel the energy. And
the
it was
tension.
Just like the... Yeah, it was one of those things where my mom always needed attention. You know, she was always like, am I pretty? Am I pretty? My dad's like, yes, you're beautiful. You're beautiful. And eventually got, yeah, you're so pretty. Everybody thinks you're so, oh my God, boys, isn't your mother just pretty?
Gosh.
And,
okay.
And it got ugly. And we were around it, you know, but they were also like weird. They were just like, you know, look, you got to respect. They told it how it was, but you know, they'd be like, Michael, how are you this stupid? How
wow.
could you not figure
okay.
these math problems out? How could you? It was
how
a
old
very,
were you when it?
Oh, very. It was very dark. I was very young. I was probably 8 or 9 years old.
Oh gosh!
I didn't know.
But that's when you're totally sentient through the whole thing because you really get some of the sophisticated stuff.
I mean,
oh,
I don't know.
God,
but
sorry, man.
It was just a weird thing. I was colorblind and I didn't know it. So I just thought I was really dumb. I went to get tennis strings at the Gus Derner Sports in Evansville, Indiana, at the mall. My dad goes, what strings do you want? I go, those yellow ones. He goes, what strings do you want? I go, the yellow ones. He goes, those are green. What the hell's wrong with you?
I'm colorblind, Dad.
I didn't know that. But anyway, it was like, it was, and I'm forgiving, and I, you know, I talk about stuff, but like, you pretty much had a good childhood. Your parents, I mean, this is, I've never heard of anything like this, where now everybody's so close and... Rob, you're going to say something.
Yeah. Did you resent your dad when you thought he left and didn't try to come back? And then did that kind of change things?
No, I didn't. I didn't at the time. The crazy thing was that divorce was still fairly uncommon back in those days. And I got this just overwhelming amount of sympathy from my friends and my schoolmates. So at the time, I didn't think being a child of divorce was a terrible thing.
Wow.
Because suddenly it defined who I was as that strong kid who went through the divorce, you know, and yeah. You survived, man. And so to me, it was like it made me special, which was ridiculous. But at the time, I don't recall feeling horrible about it. Also, by the way, my mom flourished as a single woman. She became a playwright and had a great circle of friends, and our house was just this happy place full of music. And
so your dad was holding her back.
Well, I don't know. They were only together till I was 4,
yeah,
so I have no idea what it was like before then. I didn't perceive it as, you know, we stayed in the same apartment. We went through some financial difficulties, but it seemed like, you know, this was the 70s in New York and everybody was going through financial difficulties at the time.
Yeah.
So it didn't feel like we were the only ones.
Inside of You is brought to you by Rocket Money. I love Rocket Money. You know why? Because everyone should have Rocket Money because it just helps you save money. How many times do we have subscriptions that we don't even know we have anymore and we're paying so much money? It's throwing away money, Ryan.
I found one.
You did it. You told me I got Rocket Money.
Okay, I found one. I'm embarrassed to say how long it's been going on, but thank you for finding it. My God, it was embarrassing.
Yeah, because it's like you want to watch some show and you go, I have to subscribe to this this streaming whatever. Mm-hmm. And you start streaming the show, you watch it, you leave, and you forget after this trial period it kicks in and it's they're charging terrible. You $10 a month. It is embarrassing.
Ugh.
You know, 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about. Before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had, you know, like, oh, I have like 5 subscriptions. I could not believe it when they showed me I was paying for like 4 extra between, you know, streaming devices and fitness apps, delivery services. It's never ending. And thanks to Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lowering your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. And I like that.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/inside. That's rocketmoney.com/inside. rocketmoney.com/inside.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
It's pretty obvious why you became an actor. With your dad as an actor, your mom playwright, you were around it. You just there's no other choice.
I always loved it. I recall going to the Fantastics, which was an off-Broadway show, one of the longest running shows ever. My dad was actually in it when I was born.
Is he a great singer?
He is. He is an amazing singer. My mom is too.
Are you a good singer?
I am not. Well, okay, here there's a story there too. Crazy thing, all through my youth, I was never a very good singer because I couldn't breathe through my nose through all of my youth. And I could never understand why everybody was resonating in their, you know, there's a whole, you know, you go to voice classes and they're always like, you know, breathe through your mask. The idea being that you breathe through your nose and all the stuff there. And I could never do that. So my singing was always very hampered and not very good. So I just was like, you know what? I'm a straight actor. That's what I do. I do straight plays.
But you can sing a little. Did you ever learn finally how to?
Well, the crazy thing was probably 10 or 12 years ago, I went to a doctor who did an MRI just of my sinuses.
Deviated septum.
Nasal polyps that totally filled up my sinuses. So there was no room in there for me to breathe. So he gave me this steroid, this corticosteroid, and suddenly I could breathe through my nose and I could sing at the age of like 48 or something, or 45.
And what do you 46. Like singing? What do you sing?
I'm a show tune guy.
You are a show tune.
I started as a show tune kid, and I always loved musicals, just couldn't really sing. And so suddenly I could sing, but there's tragedy ensues because then probably 4 or 5 years later, I develop a stomach problem where I've got acidity reflux all the time,
yeah.
And it fries your vocal cords. And so I can sing now on days when my vocal cords aren't fried. So like doing actual musical theater.
Does your wife catch you like singing? Like what would you do? You sing any like 70s love songs or like the Eagles or
who doesn't sing the Eagles?
Don't you sing a little Chicago?
No, I'm generally when I want to mortify my wife, it's generally
show tunes. Like what? Like what's a show tune?
Like, you know, Company. Yeah. You could drive a person crazy. You could drive a person mad. Doo, 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 doo. I mean, it's the, you know, nothing yeah. masculine, but that is a song right. sung by three women.
Listen, I love musicals. I love musicals. I love Barbara Streisand. And I read something where you and I have something in common where some people assumed we were gay.
Yes.
Some people yes. thought Rosenbaum's gay.
Uh-huh. Gay, he's gay, too, gay as a French horn, that yeah, Rosenbaum.
He's too comfortable with this, you know, there's something. So I think people assumed, in fact, my mother asked me once, she said, I came home from college because I was doing theater.
Mm-hmm.
Theater. Theater. Is that what Dax says? Theater?
Yep.
With the British spelling, with yes. an R-E.
Theater. And the she goes, Michael, it's okay. I have many friends that are. You can tell me. This is a very liberal family.
Mm-hmm.
Are you gay? And this is the best acting I've ever done. I go, yeah. And I let it go for about a week. And to this day, she was so mad. She's like, well, why didn't you just tell me? Why would you? She told the whole city. So I would still to this day, I think I come home and like Lucy or Peggy or Diane, her mm-hmm. friends, they'll give me that look like, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a girlfriend, do you? It's called a beard. You know what I mean? But you
they
experience
know all
that.
About the gay subculture. They watch Will and Grace.
Yeah, right.
They know it all.
But people thought you were gay. Sometimes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Because I never felt comfortable being masculine. That always felt other to me.
Was your father masculine?
Yeah, he was. But again, he was mostly out of the house when I was four.
Right.
You know, but even so, I think that was me. I think that, you know, even if I had seen him sort of model it and I decided that was what I wanted to do, it would always be me modeling it. It wasn't
authentic.
It wasn't authentically right. me. So people thought I was gay for the longest time. And, you know, and
did it bother you?
No. I mean, it bothered me in that I was a little, I would say I was a little ashamed that I wasn't a masculine kid, that I wasn't good at sports and I wasn't, you know, and by the way, not that that's necessarily masculine, but
right.
But the stereotypical things that people think right. about masculinity, I didn't have a particularly commanding presence. I wasn't, you know, assertive in the way that you're
They're
supposed
to be.
They're
just who you were.
It just wasn't
people
who I
like
am.
To say things. They like to judge. They like to, no matter if you are yeah. gay, you're not gay. Oh, Rosenbaum. I remember people saying, you know, back in the, I don't know if you experienced this, but when I was in high school, Rob, I don't know if you did because you're a lot younger than me. What are you, 29 with two kids, this guy already?
Jeez, with two.
One kid and I'm 30.
Yeah. No, I can't believe I fucked
he's
that
He's a Mormon.
Up.
He has 8 children. He's going on his mission right after this. You're coming up with a whole alternate history.
Oh my God, I've been working with Rob for a year and a half. I don't know anything about him. But
Rob is a Jesuit priest, interestingly. But interesting backstory Rob has. tell him your story.
He does.
No, I'm not a Jesuit. I don't know what you're talking about,
Michael. Did anyone think you were gay, Rob, ever?
No.
No?
Never? Maybe they just didn't say it.
Yeah. I mean, no, not right. I didn't get that, no.
I was just always shocked. Like, really? You think I'm gay? My wardrobe guy on Smallville, Steve, used to go, Michael, you're like a half a bottle of tequila away from being gay. Let's be serious here. You listen to Barbara musicals. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would sing all day.
Yeah.
We'd sing musicals together. And he's like, are you sure? I'm like, no. I mean, I would tell you. If I was gay, I would go around S&Ds, man. I mean, like, I love women. So mm-hmm. if I loved men, I would not hold back. I'd yeah. be like, I love D's. That's just who I am. Uh-huh. And I know it's very difficult. I had Fortune Feimster, you know her?
Sure.
You know, and we talked about, you know, growing up and being gay and like how hard that is. You know, it was just like she never would tell anyone until she was in her like 20s. I just can't imagine having that sort of, you know, and I grew up in Indiana being a Jew. I mean, people thought it was hard, but it wasn't that bad. But I remember there's a couple of gay people in our school and I remember wanting to be friends with them because I could tell that they were treated a little differently. They were kind of loners in a way. I mean, this was the 80s, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
mid 80s.
Yeah.
So it was like,
well, yeah, I had a very different experience because I went to a theater camp in upstate New York for my summers. That was the first place where being gay was not a subculture there. It was the culture.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of gay guys. So that was fascinating because I went from, you know, New York City schools, which were, there were definitely gay kids, to a place where there was a whole gay culture.
And if you're in the theater world, that's just a huge part of the culture.
Exactly.
So I feel kind of lucky that, don't you feel sort of lucky that you got to experience that? Because
oh, yeah.
being in the theater community, it's so diverse. And it was almost like it was this little subculture, this little world where everybody could sort of be themselves, at least most of themselves yeah. or some of themselves. And that was kind of cool to be around that. And I experienced that a lot in college. And that, I think I grew up a lot, mm-hmm. knowing that, hey, this is how things work. This is the real world.
Yeah, well, also that summer camp was great because a lot of kids went there whose parents just didn't know what to do with them. So there was a lot of kids who would bloom, you know, and that was really remarkable, you know, because kids are mean. Kids are clicky and mean and say mean things and stuff like that. And there would be kids that everybody would sort of write off. Suddenly, they would... you know, bloom as performers, and you'd be like, whoa, who is that person? Right. Yeah. you know, yeah. They would find who they were, which was amazing. And so I sort of came into my own as an effeminate heterosexual dork because I was there with a lot of women, the girls, you know, obviously I was, you know, 12. I went there from the time I was, I think, 13 through the time I was 17, you know, with a lot of girls my age. Who I was, you know, infatuated with because there was just these amazing.
But they didn't
girls
want any
there.
Part of you.
No, they did. They no.
See,
they absolutely did. I knew it.
Because you're charming as shit. You're sweet as hell.
That was a place where the fact that I was effeminate did not hurt at all. They totally got that. That's just who I was. You know, didn't work at my regular junior high and high school. And I was fine with that. But it was interesting. It was because I realized, you know, that that's just me. And I could try to be, you know, I could butch it up, right. as they say, or I could just be me.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the great things about being an actor, too, is you just get to be different people all the time.
Well, people are always saying, well, you were gay in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You were trans in Sweet November. You were in Drag and Sorority Boys. Is there something you want to tell us?
Yes, I
feel really comfortable in a dress.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that. I'm mm-hmm. so comfortable in a dress.
I'm not.
Are you not?
No.
Why is that?
I mostly.
I'm not.
I'm not. Just because it always feels like there's just not enough clothes on me.
Really? You're a private guy.
Yeah.
You don't like to be your shirt off. You don't like your pants off unless it's with your wife.
It's fun to adopt it as a character.
You could do that as a character.
As a character, I could absolutely. I mean, I've done it. I did it. They made a female persona for Alan on 2.5 Men on one of the last episodes we shot. With Gene, as a matter of fact, where they made me up in full, you know, and I was adorable, if I'm just going to put that out there.
What was good about it?
I had a very sunny disposition as a woman. I look a little bit like Jennifer Love Hewitt. I have a picture on my phone.
Let me see.
I have
it.
A picture on my phone.
You might have to post that.
No, I'm not. Oh wait, why not post it?
Yeah,
what
it was on
saying?
The air.
It was on the freaking air. At one point, I was they had a scene in 2.5 Men where I was tied up in lingerie. I was wearing lingerie and tied to a bed. It was an episode with Alice and Janney. And my wife came over and took a picture of me all tied up to the bed, just giggling the whole time. And I said, "Don't put that on the internet." And then I was like, why not? It's in the freaking show.
Yeah, 10 million people are watching you.
Exactly. Nobody.
Go ahead, correct me. You're like, 20. Uh-uh.
Yes.
What were you going to say? You fuck. 20 million.
We used to do like 16 million. 16. That was our.
I've never been on a show that got 16 million ever. Never been on a show like that. And that's
no,
fine.
It's
you want,
fine.
You want some
it's
blueberries?
Fine.
Want some blueberries?
No, I'm
John?
Good. Now I'm going to. I'm just going to idly go through all my pictures here. There's a photo. You can't even see it in a podcast. So what?
Yeah, but I could see it, and then I could, you know,
you could relay it to them and say,
exactly,
it's true. He looks like.
You know what? Email me that picture. You and I also have something in common in that we both were replacements in a lot of things in our life, and we both had a lot of things canceled.
Yes.
You know, and I think that creates, you know, there's something humble about that. It makes you like, you know, I think it's frustrating, and then you get to a point where you're just like, you know what? Things happen and you've had a lot of success. So, you know, if that was all you were, was like one failure after another.
If
we
didn't
have any failure, I think it wouldn't be as good.
It makes me so grateful for the times when it's good and you know you have a job next week. And boy, I treasure that stuff.
They fired Jeremy Renner. and hired, really? And hired me. They fired Simon Rhett. It was a pilot called Zoe Duncan, Jack and
Jack
Jane.
And the Yes, Selma Blair.
Yeah, and I was Jack.
Oh my
and she
God.
Was Jane and
oh my God. I
Zoe,
remember that show.
Yes.
That was a funny show.
It was funny. It was short lived, but, you know. But that happened a lot of times where people say, hey, so-and-so can't do it. Will you do it? So-and-so's fired. We'll get Michael yes. Rosenbaum. I was never the guy who got the part. I was the guy who took over.
Uh-huh.
Which is fine.
Which is fine. No, it doesn't matter. You're still the one who gets on the air.
Well, no one knows who Jeremy Renner is now either.
Exactly. Yeah, right. That's the great thing. He
Oscar
is exiled.
Oscar nominee. Has he won an Oscar? I don't know.
No,
Hurt Locker, maybe?
He might have been nominated for Hurt Locker.
I think he might have been.
But did you ever
go through with all these, like, when you had failed shows and things that didn't work and you got... let me see this.
Okay, I just found the photo.
Wait a minute. Wow. Oh, okay. My God.
See, I'm adorable. I'm adorable.
I swear to God, I'm not even kidding around. I would fuck you.
Yeah, thanks.
Look at this.
This is not where I thought this podcast was going.
You're
today.
Really
I'm just
going to
say that.
Look
Michael
at your
Rosenbaum.
Short hair and your little smile.
When you invited me on Inside of You, this was not where I expected this was going. And perhaps that's my fault.
The show
is called Inside of
You. I want to get inside John Cryer.
You know?
You are adorable. You send that to me so I can... I'm not kidding. Didn't you think he was attractive?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Rob. Rob, by the way, is a unicyclist.
A father of
six.
Six. Yeah. He's a professional unicyclist in Circus Vargas over in Burbank, a wonderful family circus that he's been in for how many years now, Rob?
About 9 or 10.
Yeah, 9 or 10 years.
But did you ever get like depressed from like things that got canceled? Did you ever did you ever really get in your head like, they don't love me, they don't like me, they don't want me?
Yes, I will tell you a story, young Michael Rosenbaum.
How old are you, by the way?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I am 53.
Are you?
Yeah, but I look great.
You look great.
But shaving off all your
hair.
You
don't drink,
helps.
Do you?
I do. Copiously.
You look really good. I'm 47. I think you look younger than me.
No, I don't. Agree.
Yeah, I think you
I
do.
I don't agree. But
if you had hair, you definitely look younger than me. And you have a little beard, for sure. For sure.
Well, thank
but go
you.
Ahead. Go ahead. Tell me the story about.
No, but when I the first show I did on television was back in 1989. It was called The Famous Teddy Z, and I had done feature. I had started in feature film. Well, I started in theater, obviously, and then I started getting feature film jobs. And I had this great run of did a movie called No Small Affair, and then Pretty in Pink, and got very lucky very fast, and had a blizzard of film roles. But then I managed to pick a bunch of duds that all came out in the same year. In 1987, I had like four
failures.
Bad movies come out, and all of a sudden I was done.
That's how the business is.
And so in 1989, I got offered a chance to work with a guy named Hugh Wilson, who had done WKRP in Cincinnati, which is one of my favorite shows. And he was going to develop a show for me. And so he wrote this thing called The Famous Teddy Z that was about agents. It was a very inside show. It was a multi-camera comedy. When I first read it, I thought, you know what? I'm actually not the right guy for this. I know he developed it for me, but I'm not the right guy for this because he wrote me as the sort of nice guy in the middle of all the crazies. And I was like, I don't want to be the nice guy in the middle of all the crazies. I want to be one of the crazies. At any rate, everybody talked me into doing it. They said, you should do the show. Everybody's excited about it. You love WKRP. You know this guy's a great writer. I said, okay, great. We started the show, and the critics loved it. Critics went nuts for it. They loved how inside it was, and it was very mean to Hollywood, and I was okay with it, but I didn't like being the nice guy in the middle of the crazies. It was always going to be a little bit of a square peg in a round hole for me. We were on. They gave us this primo time slot. We were on, I think, after Murphy Brown or something. And the elderly among you will remember that show. But that was a incredibly sought after place. It was on CBS on Monday nights, and we out of the gate did very well our first couple episodes, and then we started plummeting. The show, this awful tension crept into shooting the show, and they fired the writers and hired a bunch of new ones and this and that. And it was just, the atmosphere became acrid with, you know, just recrimination. No, we didn't. We lasted half a season. And I took that so personally, because for some reason I decided that show, that it was my job to carry that show, and it was my job to give the audience somebody to latch on to. The audience would see all these crazy characters through me, the
nice
guy.
And you didn't
want to
do the role.
And I didn't want to do it. But I so personalized it by that time that it just crushed me when that show got canceled.
Did you fire everybody around you?
No, I didn't. I turned my hatred inward. As one does in this business.
Were you still married to your first wife then?
No. This was long before my first wife.
Oh, yeah, that was long. It was the 90s.
Yeah, this was 1989. Fall of the Soviet Union, dude. This is that far back.
But you were just like... That's hilarious.
This is a while ago. So at any rate, so I took that one really hard, because at that point also I had bought into the idea of you having... You know, the flip side of you deciding, I have agency over my life. I decide what happens to me. I decide, you know, I manifest the good things that happen in my life. The flip side of that is when things don't turn out that way, no matter how much good energy you put into them, you say, oh, wait a minute. I'm responsible for the way this didn't work, you know. And
how do you turn it around?
To me, well, I how did I turn it around?
Of course, the easy answer is get another job.
Yeah.
But is that like, but you got to turn it, there's got to be something in your mind that for all of us, there's people out there all the time that do something and they fail, or they get fired from a job they loved or whatever. And the question is, how strong are you? How much do you have to dig deep? Because the easy way out is like, I'm done with my life. Fuck this. Or you have to say, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going after it. I'm going to keep going. Because really, that's what you have to do.
Yeah. No, I just kept going. I did break up with my girlfriend. That kind of helped.
It did?
Didn't
you need someone to love on you, boy?
No. I was in a bad place. And it was totally not her fault. Totally my own thing. But I needed a reset. I needed to start over and do theater. I did a play downtown in Los Angeles. And the thing is, this was back in the 80s, when doing a play downtown, nobody is going to see your play if you're doing it downtown. Yeah. If you're doing it, you know, it's just not happening. Nobody is seeing it. But it was just to make me feel a
again.
Part of it. I spent a few years, I went back to New York City and spent a lot of time back in New York City, which always makes me feel better. Because as an artist, when you're in New York, you're getting constant input, you know, just because life is just this, you know, the nastiness of life is just all around you all the time.
Right.
You know, in LA, you can really take yourself out of that if you choose. If you're in a performance art, you often need a lot of input to put a lot out, you know? And I've always kind of been like that, you know? So I try to go back to New York and spend time in New York, where I grew up a lot.
Do you like being recognized?
Do I like being recognized?
Was there a time when you were like, you know, cause you know, people obviously would come up to me, hey, Lex Luthor, hey, nice ball, that whatever.
Yeah.
But people come up and say, oh, Ducky from, did it ever get like, oh, fuck.
There was a couple of bad periods during the Sheen craziness. It was bad because it was paparazzi and Sheen fans.
They wanted to know information from you.
Yes.
Were on set. What did you see?
And also there was a contingent of people who were mad, they felt that, Sheen got a raw deal.
Like
and,
Hugh was the bad guy. Hugh Laurie, right? No, not Hugh Laurie.
Chuck Laurie.
Chuck Laurie.
Hugh Laurie is not a good guy either. I'm here to tell you. You better stay away from Hugh Laurie.
Wait a minute. Is Chuck Laurie a good guy?
Chuck Laurie is a good guy.
I've heard a lot of stories. I've heard a lot of things. I've heard from a lot of different people, and I've heard impossible to work with.
That's not for actors. Not for actors on the show, and certainly not for Charlie Sheen. That was the crazy thing, that Charlie and Chuck didn't get along was absolutely nuts, because Chuck did whatever Charlie wanted.
What it was was that
Chuck was Chuck had gone through AA, and so had Charlie, and Chuck was seeing that Charlie was starting to use again, and was saying, dude, you have to get your life together. You cannot keep, you know, you're going to sink into this and it's going to get worse. And you're not going to be able to do this show.
Which
and your
sounds
life's
like friendly advice.
Yes, exactly. And Charlie was like, I don't want to hear that from my boss. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm going to be held accountable, you know, for my off, you know, for my out of work behavior at my work.
Because he was going, supposedly he knew all his lines. He never missed a beat and his work ethic was pretty good. Now you look at me like that's not entirely true because that's the persona.
Yeah.
That he had it together when it was, when he needed to get it together. Was that true?
That was mostly true. He was remarkable, in terms of being able to perform when he had been partying.
How do you
previously?
Do that? I drink three drinks. I can't remember.
Yes,
my lines.
Me too. I don't know how he did it. He did it way back in the early 90s when he and I did Hot Shots together. He was, you know, he was still partying a lot, and I would just hear stories, and he'd come in and hit his marks and know all his lines, and he would get it in two takes and be terrific. And I was like,
Would you smell his breath? Could you smell liquor on his breath at all?
No,
could you go,
not
oh my
really.
God, he's fucked up.
He was a big, you know,
breath spray
guy.
Right.
But and lovely to work with. By the way, super friendly. Would come in first thing in the morning. You know, big hellos to everybody in the trailer. You know, and lovely guy.
I met him a year and a half ago. I was asked. He saw a movie I directed, and he wanted me to direct this movie that he was starring in a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I went in and I sat with him and I went out with him and had a cigarette and I immediately loved him. He's one of the most charming people I've ever met. I don't know him other than I was, and then I said, hey, you know, I'm not going to do the movie or whatever. And then he called me and goes, yeah, I quit too. I'm not doing it either.
Okay.
I was like, it just needs too much work. It needs too much rewrite. But what I know, look, it was One Day with Charlie and that should be a movie, One Day with Charlie. And he was totally, you know,
yes, he's
eccentric, but you were there.
He's capable of being incredibly charming, and my experience with him was great.
90%
for 6 years, it was fantastic. But when he started using again, he showed up less. You know, we would have days where no Charlie. You know, today we're just we're going through with
did that
his,
make you mad?
With his, you know, no, he was his. Wife had gone through difficult childbirth with their kids, so there were issues with their kids that he was trying to attend to. So sometimes he was missing it because of that, but sometimes it clearly wasn't that, you know. And we still functioned fairly well because he would come in on Friday and he knew his lines, you know.
He did. Just he knew his lines
he
on
did.
Fridays.
But I would say the last year, and also by the way, he was. Good to the crew. He was nice. He was not being a jerk. He was, you know, until that last season. That last season, there was stuff going down that was, you know, he would, I could see him throwing a fit backstage. It was uncharacteristic. His timing was a little bit off. He would come in and he seemed wired, you know, and you could see it in his off time that he seemed wired. But when he had to perform, he could still do it.
Did you feel an energy like throughout the crew and everybody just going like, are you guys witnessing what I'm witnessing?
Yes.
You could definitely feel like this, there's something, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It was everyone's uncomfortable.
Well, it was fascinating because the day that Ashton came to work, it was like we all exhaled. Because even though Charlie was not a jerk, there was just this underlying tension because you didn't know if he was going to show up. You didn't know what crazy thing was going to come out of his mouth. You didn't know what
he was going to insult.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know,
he said whatever came off his mouth.
Yeah, exactly. So there was just this tension that was in the air. And it was crazy because Charlie totally, whenever he was unhappy with the show, whenever he was unhappy with lines that he had or whatever, he could have just said, guys, can we beat this joke? Because this is a lox. There's nothing, this is not good.
But what did he do?
He didn't say it. He would come to me before that and he would say, oh, this whole run is just terrible. Then we would do it for the run through and it would kill. And then he would shut up and not complain. And instead of just saying, guys, I know you like this, but it just really doesn't work for me, which he could have said. And you know what? They would have just totally rewritten it and it wouldn't have been a problem. But he couldn't bring himself to do it. So then it all just exploded in this anger at Chuck at the end of it that was like we were all blindsided. He never did that in front of Chuck or to Chuck's face. Never once. It was just on the internet in the middle of the night.
So him and Chuck never really had a...
They never fought.
Isn't that something?
They never fought. Chuck,
that sounds like one of my girlfriends I dated a while. We just fought on the phone. Not in front of people.
Not in front of
people. Not in person.
It's very similar.
It was just on the phone.
Well, but Chuck was absolutely blindsided by the whole thing. He
hurt.
And he always felt like I was just trying to get Charlie to get help. Basically, the explosion happened when Charlie wanted to come back to work and get paid again. And Chuck said, "You're not ready to come back." He did a week of at home rehab, and he was not ready.
Right.
And
just tired. And
yeah, no, his voice was still a mess. He was still clearly using. And Chuck said, "You need a lot more time." And that's when the diatribes began.
Did you find yourself like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place? Because you're like, I love this guy of 6 years who's been part of my life and like a brother. We worked on Hot Shots. Now all this shit's happening. I don't want to be stuck in the middle. I love him, but there's obviously some fucked up. He's fucked up right now.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And he was taking it out on his family. Remember, he was arrested for battery. That's horrifying. And so you don't know how to, support somebody like that.
You disconnect,
and you want to support him, but I also, his he's got a wife and kids, people who are getting hurt by this on a daily basis. Plus everybody was losing their job. That was another thing. You got a whole crew of, 130 people.
So you built
people.
Some resentment. I think everybody has a lot of resentment. Yeah. It just built and built. It was like, there's one of, get out of jail free card a few times.
A few times. But
and then at the end, you're like, you know what? Now you're hurting other people. And that was it. So have you heard from him since? Do you talk?
Yeah. No, we don't talk. He's occasionally on, and he does shit on social media. That's like, what the fuck? He put out this gif that was a moment from Two and a Half Men of Alan sort of groveling to Charlie because he's begging to stay in the house, and he was like, "This is Cryer wanting to do Two and a Half Men again." And I was like I'm begging him to do two. It's actually it was like what?
So
what?
You're just
it was
insulted.
A weird
like,
it was a weird swipe out of nowhere.
For no reason.
Because
you've never been someone to talk about badly about the guy.
No.
These are just facts.
Yeah.
That's got to be tough. That's got to be
It was very
really
weird
tough.
And just, an odd thing.
I can tell you, just by you talking about it, you were hurt. Like, it was a hurtful time. Like, it was like...
Sure. It was an awful time because I was also worried that he was going to die. So this is something that everybody who's related to or in the orbit of an addict goes through.
Sure.
And so I was not alone. And I, I have my own issues with him. I wish him the best. I really do. I've heard that he's getting healthier lately, which I'm thrilled about. I hope he gets his life together. But, it was an awful time to go through. And I wish he had stayed sober. Because he had everything.
He's brilliant.
Because he's a brilliant actor.
Brilliant. Comedic chops like nobody else.
Yes. I wish he, stopped hurting people. And he
and himself.
And himself. But, there are a lot of addicts, when things are great. And he was the highest paid performer.
Million an episode,
in
right?
One of, something around there. I never knew the exact figure. But in an already ridiculously overpaid profession.
Oh, yeah.
And he had everything. He had kids. He had a family. He had whatever he wanted, and he had to blow it up.
But something was broken
inside. He had to blow it up.
Happens.
I'm sad for him. I hope somebody else gives him a chance, but it's probably not going to be me.
right. Let's get into good news here.
Yes.
Let's get into good news, and that's that you are Lex Luthor on Supergirl. And this is what so many people are just, the internet's booming. It's like, holy shit.
It was controversial.
But
everything is controversial on the internet. So
it is.
I
didn't have to experience that on Smallville. I didn't have to experience the internet. I didn't I didn't have to experience like, oh, Rosenbaum, he's going to suck. He can't fill Gene Hackman's shoes. He can't. But like when you're getting a role that someone else has played, you're always compared. You're being compared before you even, like, give me a fucking chance before you start. And I'm reading these going, you motherfuckers, leave the guy alone. He hasn't even done this yet. But a lot of people are like, hey, I can't wait. You could see the
support.
Some
people were excited.
And I immediately remember I was one of the first one. I was like, retweet and said, hey, man, kick some ass or whatever I said. Like, I was like, dude. You know, go have fun and you're a great actor and you're going to fucking kill it.
I was so appreciative that you said that, by the way, because that carries a lot of weight with the fans and the people who care about the DC universe and, you know, people like me, people who are geeks like me. Although right. I was more of a Marvel kid growing up, but right. I'm all respect for the DC universe as well. But my point being, I want to respect that universe and respect that character in that universe as well. And the great thing about Smallville was it was a great reimagining of the sort of
right.
Superboy mythology.
The story.
Exactly. And I thought, oh, it was so clever.
But this isn't. Mm-hmm. You're not given time to say, here's my backstory.
Yeah.
You are just Lex. And let me tell you something. If I was just Lex Luthor when he was already Lex Luthor, I don't think anybody would have cared for me at all. So it's such a hard to do that. And you're going in. It's like I don't envy the position of going into something that's so, you know, there's so much history behind it. And you're just going. Did you get anxiety? Did you get nervous?
You know,
were you?
Interestingly, it was a weird process because, as I said, I first got the call from the producers. And I thought, why me? Because I, as I said, I would not be the first person that I would think of to do that part. But once they sort of filled me in on where they wanted to go with him, I thought, oh, well, yeah, I can do that. And so, so I have not been anxious about it. I have been
excited,
just excited, you know, a little anxious once we actually started shooting, because it was like, you know, now is put up or shut up time, Crier.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. Again, if you're listening to this, you know, John might say some things that this is aired. So
yes, so yes. Hopefully, you will have seen the show because you have to watch the show on the night it airs because that's how you are. So hopefully, you're that much of a fan of Supergirl.
Yeah. So stop, and if you haven't, watch it and come back to the rest of this.
Yes.
Interview.
If you're worried about spoilers, there will be spoilers.
What was the first scene that you set that up for me? And
well,
what you're thinking.
What's great about what the writers wanted to do was. The very first scene you see me, you know, is in full Luthorian grandeur, pulling off a huge anti-Superman, basically a genocidal plan to that will kill Superman, but, you know, probably a million human beings at the same time. So this is when Luthor is in his glory, you know, doing what he loves best, doing what he was put on Earth to do. But then they switch it up, where you realize that's a flashback and he's actually been released from prison on a mercy furlough because he's deathly ill. And he's coming to his sister, who Lena Luthor, who's this you know, amazing scientist, for her help to find a cure for himself.
Right.
It's you get a glimpse of Luthor, but then he's just this decrepit, dying soul, and you've got to wonder where he's coming from. You know, he's absolutely the opposite of what you would expect from Luthor.
So it's a little convoluted. It's a little
it's a little
ambiguous. A little bit like you're like, what are we dealing with here?
Yes, you don't know what he's actually up to. You know, is he just begging for his life? You know, from the sister that he's trying to dredge the last bit of love between them up from. You know,
right.
Or is this part of some bigger plan? You know,
right.
And that was really fun to play.
When they say action, and mm-hmm. it's your first words coming out of Lex Luthor's mouth, was there part of you that's still in that moment going, "I'm playing Lex Luthor. I'm Lex Luthor."
Absolutely,
I do. I've done that.
Well, because the first shot was actually in a helicopter, and it's the first time I see Supergirl in the flesh. I've not I've seen Superman, but this is the first time I'm meeting Supergirl, and I'm just spoiling for a fight. And but the line is supposed to be whispered, so it's like the smallest little moment, you know. And I realized this is the first time I'm being committed to film as this character, you know, that a lot of people really care about.
Sure.
And so I was probably overthinking it a little.
And what was that line?
It's
what
just,
was the whisper?
It was just, Supergirl, it's nice to finally meet you. You know, so...
how many takes did you do? Not that many.
Not that many. I mean, what's nice is they actually have a lovely brisk. They shoot a lot of it with a lot of handheld and quick and dirty, and everybody's having fun.
It's good.
It really is. It's a great set.
Feels raw. Alive, right?
It's a great set. Performers are just so lovely, and you know, a lot of time when you're a guest performer,
it's so hard
because everybody's got their friends.
This is the family.
All, yeah,
and
exactly.
Now you're going into this family going, oh, hi guys, I'm here today.
Yes, and I'm here to do awful things and then leave, you know?
Yeah.
But they were fantastic. But also, this was also very freighted for me personally, because seeing the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve was just this jaw-dropping experience for me as a 14-year-old boy. I just loved it. It was one of the things I fell in love with movies for, was, you know, that scene in The Fortress of Solitude where he just leans forward and starts flying for the first time. You know, and it was, you know, at the time, it was a big deal that to have such a beautiful, seamless shot of somebody flying in such a believable way. You know, it was the whole selling point was, you will believe a man can fly. And I did. I was 14 and I bought it 100%. And I love Gene Hackman in that movie, even though he was he was a departure from Luther from the comics, you know, he was a little different guy. And, but I still loved him. I thought he did a great job. So he was kind of the definitive on-screen Luther for me, obviously, until Smallville.
you don't have to say that.
I did love Smallville. But again, that was a departure from the comics. But in a great way.
And a lot of times you're only as good as the production value, the writing, what's around you. I've said this before. I think I've been pretty good in some stuff that's just not good. And if it's not good, then you're not good. No one cares.
It's nice to be good in something that's not great. But nobody wins.
Yeah, exactly. Unless the writing's good, unless the production's good, if all these things come together in the perfect storm, it's a thing called luck.
It is. Oh, absolutely.
And it's a
slip and loop.
What it is, a commodity of preparation and opportunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like, you know, I hope this is for you. I hope this is like, you know, this people are loving it. And
I hope so too. But don't you admire those amazing performers who manage to do that a lot, who manage to somehow the stars align that they end up in a lot of really good things? And you're like, wow, you know, obviously they're good. You know, but plenty of good people don't end up in that many good things.
That's true. Very true.
And I admire the people who either through its, you know, astute choices or great management or who knows, just end up, you go, wow, they just, Matt Dillon, you know, I always thought he's a good actor. You know, he's terrific. But oh my God, the body of work.
From the outsiders you know? To something about Mary.
Exactly,
to,
exactly. And it's
Rumblefish
like,
to, yeah.
So, you know, he has taste. He has, there's something there that he just ends up in a lot of great
Did you ever see The Bodyguard? Not the one with Whitney Houston, but maybe it was My Bodyguard. It was with
Adam Baldwin.
Yeah, Baldwin. Matt Dillon's the bad guy.
Yes.
Wasn't that a great
That
Whitney?
Was a great
Ruth
movie.
Gordon.
Terrific movie.
Come over here, you little.
Yeah.
Love Ruth Gordon.
But I was bringing this around to when I got my chance to be in a Superman movie. I was in Superman 4 playing Lenny Luthor, Lex Luthor's evil nephew, who was basically a replacement for the Ned Beatty character.
Right.
You know, it was basically this stupid sidekick. And I was so excited because the script was terrific, and Christopher Reeve had written the story, and they had gotten the whole cast back together. You know, they'd gotten Margot Kidder back. They had got, you know, a lot of them had fallen out for Superman 3, you know, the one with Richard Pryor, and they had gotten Jackie Cooper back, and they had gotten, you know, they had really assembled this great group, and Gene Hackman came back. Everybody had thought 3 was a misfire, but 4 is going to fix everything. And we got into production, and clearly the producers, who had been known as kind of schlocky producers, they were Golan Globus, who had done Delta Force, you know, and all these like schlocky movies that had made a bunch of money. They ran out of money. So they started cutting weeks out of the schedule.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
It was a nightmare. And the movie's terrible. The movie's absolutely terrible.
I don't think I ever saw the fourth one.
It's terrible.
But you got to work with Christopher Reeve.
I got to work with Christopher Reeve, Margot Kidder. Which was great.
Who I got to meet both of them.
Lovely. And Gene Hackman. I was his sidekick. Gene Hackman. You know, I got to be Gene Hackman's sidekick. So
can you call Gene? Have him on the show?
You know, we're out of touch. We haven't kept
I don't think he's been in touch with many people.
But my point being, this ended up being a very, very painful experience for me. I literally felt like that I had let down the 14-year-old kid in me, you know, because I really, I wanted it to be the thing that resurrected the Superman franchise, not the thing that really, that put the nail in the coffin, you know?
Yeah.
So I was devastated about it. And they gave me this chance to be a part of that legacy in a really good way, that I just had this opportunity I was so jazzed about. I was so excited about that. And that the writers really paid it off and have come up with a really fun way to do it. It's been an ideal experience.
But, you know, I think I look at you and I'm like, this is a guy who's faced adversity and had failed projects and had some big success. And then, you know, this, it's this cyclical thing, right? You have a big success and then all of a sudden it's your shit, you know, you're in these projects that just don't happen like you want them to. And you just keep coming back. You keep fighting. You're a good actor. You're a good guy. You're just like, but you just keep, where a lot of people would say, fuck this. I can't do it. These are why these opportunities will come back. They will come back around. If you just stay with it, these opportunities, and then the 2.5 Men
out of nowhere
blew up, and it was the biggest success probably on television, one of the biggest success stories ever. So to me, I would have quit right after that. I would have just bought an island in the Bahamas, and I'm done. No more. I'm on the top. Let's get out of here. But you know, you just keep going, and that's I love it. I love that you got this opportunity. This has been an incredible treat because we didn't really know each other other than you showing up a week early but,
and practically moving into your house.
But yeah, but this has been so. Supergirl airs Sunday nights.
Yes.
What time?
Yes. I believe it's 8 o'clock on CW.
This has been great. You have such a huge career. You've had done so many things, and will you come back sometime?
Sure, sure. I'm in the neighborhood.
You
actually
live
not
like
that
right
far
over the hill.
Yes, you don't. Yeah, I could make it seem like it's a pain in the ass, but it's not.
Anyway, sorry, you had to walk up the hill. I saved you a parking spot.
You did, which was very cool.
You needed some exercise.
If I come back, I will swing by.
I move the van.
Yes, thank you. Yes, by the way, that is a very disturbing van.
I've had it 15 years. It was just my parents. That, you know, I used to have friends that parents would have vans and they would take their kids on road trips, and my parents never had one. So I always said that if I ever make any money, $40,000, I'm gonna buy a van, I'm gonna take my friends on road trips, I'm gonna go to all these places, and you know, that's why I have it. I can't get rid of it. It's worth $7,000 Blue Book now, but I can't get rid of it.
You tried to sell it this weekend.
I tried to sell it to Dax Shepard, and he goes, uh-huh. I go, $7,000 or $8,000. No, that's too much.
But going on a road trip in a van, it's not actually the ideal vehicle.
You know what?
For a road
screw
trip.
You, John. Screw you. By the way, what's your Twitter and your Instagram? So people.
My Twitter is at Mr. John Cryer on Twitter, and I'm not on Instagram. Right? Yeah, I am. I have, but I just have a placeholder account because there was a lot of fake accounts, and so.
Well, if you don't know John as well as you should, he's been in pretty much everything. He's worked with pretty much everybody. And that's why I think the next time we could talk, there's so many other things we could.
Oh, there's many things.
Tap into it.
No. We're just getting started. This is going to be a whole offshoot. This is a pod just inside of John Cryer.
Yeah,
it's going to be its own
really
offshoot.
This is thanks so much for coming. Thanks for allowing me to be inside of you. This has been a
thank you
real treat.
Again, I should have seen that coming.
And you're a really good human being. You know, you're just don't you think, Rob? It's this disposition that's just so genuine, nothing to hide. Here I am. What do you want to know? This is how I feel. I'm Lex Luthor.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wish Michael was more like you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'd finally talk and, you know.
All right, John.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The pleasure was mine.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.